Infamous Indy presents The Digging Up Dillinger Project, featuring the Texas Crime Travelers and Travis Thompson. I'm your host, Joe Malillo. In the annals of American crime, few figures loom as large as John Dillinger. A mastermind of bank heists, his name became synonymous with brazen robberies and daring escapes. Questions of whether he escaped an FBI ambush and the whereabouts of his buried loot persevere. History offers one account, but there are whispers that tell us many more. Join us as we go digging up Dillinger.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Digging Up Dillinger. I'm your host, Joe Malillo. Stuart Fillmore and Mike Thompson are here today. We're starting to get to know Mike Thompson a little better here on his second episode. We're missing two of the crew, right, Stuart? We're missing, of
course. Yeah, I think Todd maybe ate some food or something that he shouldn't have eaten, or maybe probably the true story is he might have had one too many, adult beverages, but nonetheless, he's missing in action tonight.
And Travis had to work as well. So we're gonna keep pushing forward. Mike, glad to have you back, man. How was your week? All right.
Great.
Well, it should be. You saw me. So.
Well, yeah, I got to see you in the middle of the week, live and in person.
Live and in person. So what we're gonna go over this episode. So we just want to thank everybody for listening because you came through. We had a couple of questions, more than a couple of questions, come through from viewers. I have Mike here. We're going to read the questions. That's what we asked you guys to do. And sure enough, some of the fans came through, including we're going to shout out Charlotte Stevens. She's one of the people who sent most of the questions. So we're going to give her a stage here to kind of ask whatever she wants to ask. And, there's nine questions. And then, of course, there's obviously going to be questions and discussion after. But before we go into the questions, let's just talk about what Mike, Travis, and myself got into literally on Thursday of this week at the house. I had the privilege I live pretty close to Travis and Mike. Mike, I could pull up to your house and you're there and you're like, hey, here's a whiskey and let's get going. And and it could be at 9 a.m. It doesn't really matter. You're always down. But I had the privilege to be able to be there with you as you pulled out of the safe a lot of the artifacts and documents that you have surrounding John Dillinger. So
yeah,
that was
to see they've been in there for quite a while, pulling them out and trying to find some different stuff.
Yes. Yeah, specifically, cool. We have the goal, Stuart, of going in and trying to find the letter from Germany addressed to Hubert that we've talked about on this podcast before.
Yeah.
Where we don't know why someone from Germany was writing a letter to Hubert after Hubert had died. And the only real explanation we think is that possibly that person didn't realize he passed away.
Exactly. Yep.
So, is there any research that, John could be in your mind in Germany? I mean, because that's what we were looking for. We were looking for this piece of evidence.
Yeah, I mean, not to my knowledge. I know about that letter through my work with Mike and Travis, but I don't. I haven't seen any other research about that. So again, this is potentially something like the map that has never been reported, before. It's not part of history, and very well could change the whole story. So I think it's important. It's an important lead to really run down.
Mike, we didn't find it though.
We didn't find it then, but I think I know where it is. It's in the other safe.
Yeah, there's multiple safes here.
Yeah, so we'll come across it. It's not disappeared, but you did get to see John's handkerchiefs.
That's true. So yeah, okay.
One of them looks like it may have bloodstains on.
There it is. I'm not even kidding. When it's in the plastic bag too, Stuart. Here's a great question for you.
Yes.
Though, if that handkerchief has blood on it, are we able to pull DNA from something, even though it may have been handled differently by different people over different time?
Okay, so the short answer is yes. Okay, now what can happen is when people touch that, people handle it, people sweat over it, people you know, do whatever, you know, that the other DNA can contaminate it. But what you have is, you know, if that's whoever's blood drop that is, okay, that's going to be the major contributor. So the DNA analysis is going to be able to tell, you know, who the major contributor is. Now, it does, you know, a contaminated sample does make it a little more complicated, but they definitely have ways of determining who that major contributor is. Now, it may not give us a full DNA profile. You know, that is all the markers that we need, you know, for a full profile. But it's certainly because, you know, on the map, we have DNA on the map that's a partial profile. And it's also a similar situation where there's other contributors on there. But the major contributor, obviously, is a male from the Dillinger family. So yes, it's absolutely possible, despite contamination, that a sample, a profile could be derived from that handkerchief.
So that's good. It does look brown and rusty. Is that something that you think, Stuart?
The short answer is yes, absolutely. Because I actually have seen the pants that the person was wearing that was killed at the Biograph Theater, and in the right pants pocket, there's a blood stain. And it's, you know, it's got that kind of brown, rusty kind of color to it. Absolutely. I think that would be what it is.
I don't have experience with bloodstained documents or pieces of clothing. So, you know, it's perfect for you to see. I'm going to try to pull it up here so everybody on YouTube can watch and see with us. So just give me a second. But the handkerchiefs were really cool. We also found those silver dollars.
And Joe, let me interrupt really quickly, please, just to finish the thought about the, you know, DNA.
Go.
You know, not only if you have a blood stain, that's obviously great. You know, another thing though is that the handkerchief was probably used to wipe sweat, wipe snot. You know, whatever would have been handled a lot by whoever it was, and if it's John's, then despite other people touching it, the vast majority of DNA, potential DNA on there, is going to be Dillinger's. So that could be absolutely a game changer.
I didn't touch it and I didn't open it up because, you know, I could hear about in the back of my head was Stuart saying, don't open it up.
Keep
it less contaminated as possible.
Mike, what was the first thing I said when we when we found that bottle in the mason jar? Hold up right now. Let's get some gloves. Don't do anything else.
Yeah, that's right.
That was a very good moment because I don't know if I actually heard the jar break, but I knew the expression on your face that there was definitely something there.
Yeah.
And then when I looked down and seen that the root over top of that jar and stuff, which basically saved the map because the jar popped, but that kept that shovel from going into it.
Yep.
I mean, that was definitely a great moment. But yeah, glove up.
Glove up. Exactly.
Here, let's see here, guys. I got it here. So this is going to be good. Right here. Let's see. Share this screen. Oh, so again, the J on it. I mean, look at the embroidery, Stuart. How cool is that?
Yeah, you can tell it's definitely old. It's pretty cool. What do I see there outlined in blue? The J. Now I see it.
Yeah.
So the J.
Yeah.
Okay, the J, and then it's outlined in this blue kind of diamond shape kind of thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And then what we were talking about were those on the other handkerchief behind it. You can see the blue. Or, I mean, the rust-colored blood that we thought was blood. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, like I said, blood is great, but you know, a handkerchief is also going to have sweat and snot on it. So
yeah, any bodily fluids is going to be good.
Yeah, exactly.
What I mean, I guess from my perspective too, like, what's the point of us proving that handkerchief is his, other than one of the handkerchiefs was it found on his body that night?
Well, Mom did have the shirt that was on him when he was killed. So yeah, I don't know. So I don't know if the handkerchief, yeah, she burned in the mid-60s, but so right. It was the handkerchief. Yeah.
Yeah, no, right. you're right on the right track, Mike. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Like, okay, here we go.
And then we had.
She didn't burn that.
We had the cufflinks, which I didn't bring out, but they were in the package that mom had sealed.
The cufflinks he was killed with that night. You know, is there DNA on that? But I feel like that's kind of, that could be more contaminated through handling because, you know, it, think about it. They took it off his body. Yeah. The body.
Who all?
Yeah, there's there's way less chance of any usable DNA off of cufflinks than there would be off of a handkerchief, for sure.
Okay, cool. We also had the privilege of Mike pulled out Bonnie from Bonnie and Clyde's
mother.
Yep, her mom. Yep, go ahead, Mike. Tell the story. Go right ahead, man.
Well, while my mother traveled with my grandfather on the crime doesn't pay tour, she met Bonnie's mom on that train. She kind of watched my mom while my grandfather gave the talks. So she really liked
Mom. Like babysat her, right?
Yeah, basically, because mom was only 12 when she was traveling with him. And she gave her like, oh, it's probably like three or four lengths off the watch chain that was on Bonnie when she was killed. And so mom had put them in an envelope and wrote on it, and she always had those. So those were actually on Bonnie. That was the watch chain that was on Bonnie when she was killed. So it's a few lengths off that watch chain.
How do you feel about that? Like, I know you have it, but when you pull it out, what does it make you feel like?
I don't know. It's just kind of interesting that they're connected because it's the same period of time, basically. Mm-hmm. And then mom really liked Bonnie's mom from traveling. She always talked real fond of her. So
it's incredible. I mean, really.
It's really a cool story.
I mean, to have that piece of history in your safe, along with the cufflinks that John Dillinger was killed with, those two things. I mean, you basically have two pieces of jewelry from two of the biggest gangster stories in the history of our country, and you have a literal link to those links.
You have a piece of each of them. Yeah,
it's really cool. I mean, it gives me chills, dude. Like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, you're not so special, Mike. Just the stuff you got.
This is stuff that was handed down to me.
No, I think what I'm really impressed with Mike about is everything is kept really safe, literally, like in a safe. You're doing a really good job keeping it. We have to categorize everything. We have to kind of go into it like a research library would and put it together so that we're able to find stuff. Stuart, Mike was pulling out all the envelopes, right? The manila envelopes. Yeah. So we were like looking in them, trying to find this letter. And oh my gosh, the pictures, right? We have so many. I'd love to digitize and categorize it for him, so that our fans can see it and he can have it as a way to,
right,
to find things quickly that we're looking into or that he has.
Right.
So, yeah. And plus, Mike, we want to make sure that we're documenting your memories and like what you know of based on your history and with your mom before it gets too late, before we just lose it to history. Right. So,
I tried to tell Travis and I have over the years, and which mom got to tell him a lot of stuff. So he's kind of, when he was younger, especially and was around mom quite a bit, got to hear stories and stuff. But it needs, before I totally lose my mind and don't remember anything.
You're pretty sharp right now, man. I'll tell you that. You're doing great.
Got a long way to go on that one.
Yeah, for sure. Let's do this. What, Mike, what else from the safe did we pull out the other day?
Well, you got to see Hubert's airplane.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah, with Hubert standing by his airplane.
Oh, cool. Well,
Stuart's eyes lit up when we
saw
that.
Yeah, I've never seen that. That's cool.
Like, it was John, right, next to the airplane? Was that the one that was...
It, It was Hubert standing next to his plane.
God, man, they look so similar.
Oh, yeah.
They definitely
have. Especially when he was young, Hubert Young, definitely looked like.
Definitely a resemblance, for sure.
So I got a picture.
In fact, I'm surprised that, Hubert was a little younger, though, when the hunt was on for John. So, but I was going to say, it would be surprising that Hubert didn't get arrested a couple of times.
He definitely got stopped.
Okay, yeah.
Here, we're going to pull it up for everybody because I took pictures of it. So, Stuart, I'm going to just give me a sec. We'll pull it back up. But one of the thoughts is let's look at the back of the plane to see the number, right? And then try to match those numbers up to possible routes. I mean, would we be able to figure out the history of the plane routes?
Yeah, I don't know. That's something I've never researched. I wouldn't know where the records for that would be. I don't know.
How far back would it go?
I don't know. Flight logs from 1934. You're talking to try to match with our map and everything, but
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Do you think that map could possibly been a route the plane flew?
I mean, we've certainly considered that. Wow, he looks so much like Dillinger.
Oh, isn't it crazy?
Even kind of the same, just the way he kind of is just kind of resting on the plane. It just has a very much a Dillinger thing to it.
I think he kind of looks like Mike.
And they were about the same size.
Yeah, looks like it.
Yeah.
But, one of the things we have considered about the map with that funky zigzag pattern that's on it is that, are we talking, are these airplane routes on here? It's the whole thing is still a mystery, so we don't know, but it's definitely been considered. And you do have the tail number.
Yep, got made sure to take a picture of the tail number specifically. So it's NC 22354, and that must be the plane brand or type of plane it was, kind of branded on the back there. But yeah, we have the tail number. So pulling out things out of the safe, man. It's the whole thing. Give me more meat, baby. Give me some more details so we can try.
What is it again, Joe?
It looks like North Carolina 22. Yeah. 35-4. Okay. Yeah, it's definitely an N. N is in Nancy. But gosh, I love this picture of Hubert. I really do. I mean, look at him. Look at him. You know what? He definitely looks older, right? He doesn't look like his young self.
Yeah, when did Hubert die, Mike? In 74?
74.
So? Okay.
Yeah. 2 years after I graduated.
And honestly, I should have taken a picture of the back of the picture here to figure out what was the exact date. I forget.
Yeah, I think it did have
It have the date on the back?
I believe so. Or one, there was a couple pictures, and I think the one had the date on the back.
Yeah, I didn't get the date.
I think he had more than one plane, too.
We also
at the same time, but I think he had.
Here, we'll do one more picture since we're on Hubert. I'll send it to myself here again. I think that we also saw the address book, Stuart. Mike pulled out the address
book. Yeah, I did. For me. I did
pull it out. Yeah, so, the address book is really cool.
It's so small.
It is. I recall it is. It's tiny. But then again, you have to remember, folks needed to carry around address books because, we didn't have cell phones in those days.
Really?
And so it could get really bulky. It's small because to make it more convenient, more handy.
Here he is.
Man, wow. Look at that jaw, man. Just a really, really strong jaw. And look at you got the cleft chin going on.
And Hubert always dressed nice. When he was
very much, very much so, man. Look at that. Yep. Pretty sharp.
It's pretty cool to have this. And this is just as like the smallest crumbs of stuff that we found. And we just, again, we were only going for one thing. We were going for the German letter, trying to find it. We did find another letter that was all in German, And I want to try to translate it as well. But we found a lot, you know, and when I say found, I mean, you know, obviously Mike has it, but I was pulling out the letters from people like fans of John's that would just send condolence letters after he died.
Yeah.
And
there was, yeah, several to my grandfather, and then some even to Mom.
Yeah. People had a heart back then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sure, you know, people realized, you know, that for the most part, that not for the most part, completely, you know, that the family itself were perfectly innocent in all this. And that, Frances was just a young girl, 12 years old, so I'm sure there was a lot of sympathy at the time, you know,
yeah.
people felt for him.
Yeah, I think we'll pull out some more nuggets here coming up soon. I really want to help Mike. I think we need to make a time where we can categorize. I set the camera up. I can't set my phone up on a stand, and I just start scanning all the pictures that you got, front, back, try to zoom in on a couple, and we really just start getting into, and then pull out an Excel file and start categorizing it. So as soon as we can do that, we'll bring more to you guys. And then obviously on TikTok, I'm about to put out some videos this week from my trip with Mike and Travis and the safe. And then Mike, you got the key to the other safe. So we're not even done.
Yeah. And then Stuart brought up the other one, which I hadn't even thought about, which I don't even remember what's in that safe.
Great. That's even better. Just let me be. Just be there so we can document it and put it on TikTok. Hell, we'll go live. Would anybody want to go live with the safe to see what's in there?
Like, yeah,
cracking the safe open.
Yeah, exactly. That'd be cool. Stuart, anything else about the kind of artifacts before we move on?
No, I mean that's some really cool stuff, and you know, and again. I love the opportunity to see historical photos like that you know, haven't been seen before. To me, that's really fun. I love. So thanks for sharing that, Mike. That's really cool stuff. You know, I remember when I first visited your man cave there, and we were shooting that sizzle reel for the potential show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, you had some stuff out on display and a lot of, you know, there are a lot of pictures like the, you know, from the family reunion, you know, where the famous picture of Dillinger holding the wooden gun was made, or when that was made. You know, it was really cool to see the originals of those photos. And it's amazing how crisp they are compared to what you see, you know, online or in books. So
yeah.
that's been for me a really unique thing. And, you know, and again, it's not necessarily anything that changes history, but it's a really unique insight into this case. And what I remember getting out of that, seeing those family photos, was that, you know, it's easy to think of someone like Dillinger as a historical figure, you know, think of him as a historical figure rather than as a human. And for me, that really opened my eyes to realize, you know, this is just not some guy that was a bank robber who was famous and the whole story that we know about Dillinger. This was actually somebody that he was a brother. He was a son, and it really humanized him to me. And, the story of how he goes bad and everything, you know, honestly, that could almost happen to anybody. And, you know, cause he had a regular, normal, loving childhood, and, you know, he was just somewhat of a rascal, and, you know, got involved with a guy that was really a bad influence on him, and through just an unfortunate turn of events, you know, he ends up going to prison for a long time. And it's prison, I think, that really turned him into what he became. But yeah, absolutely. You can see the love in that family. It just burst out at you when you actually see those authentic photos.
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize there was two people taking the exact same photos. Basically, Huber was a camera buff, and then my great uncle was. So a lot of those pictures, there's two different negatives to the original.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of them, the same pictures.
So. And you have those negatives too.
Yes.
Yeah. That's
or a awesome. Lot of them.
Here, I got one more thing, and we'll move on from the artifacts, because now that I'm thinking about it, we could do the whole episode on all the pictures I took from the artifacts and just show Stuart and be like, look what we found. Who is this? Who is this? Mike, Stuart, I don't know. Hold on.
Can you zoom in a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Just give me,
I don't know. The little shoe is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's like
advertising knife. It was a knife.
Okay.
Yep, a knife for those shoes. But here's the thing. That picture happened to be stuck in that shoe, just because it was in the box with the pictures. And that little picture, for some reason, got stuck and wedged in between the blade and the holder of the shoe. And we pulled it out, and it looked like it was almost like it was part of it, but it just was in the box and just stuck in there.
Yeah. But
who is that?
I don't know.
And there's nothing, no name on the back.
No.
Interesting. Kind of a handsome guy.
It's at the family farm, right?
It does. It looks like the siding that you see in the famous wooden gun picture.
And you said, Mike, there were other people there that day.
There was. Other family members, yeah.
So could it be one of those guys?
It could be. If it
is possibly one of the Hancocks?
It possibly could be.
Well, if you're watching and you're a Dillinger expert and you wanna solve some small mystery here, who is this?
Who is this?
It's kind of crazy. Anyway, so
cool.
We'll keep going. Awesome. Thanks, Mike, for letting me stop by that day. Oh. I literally got there before Travis even got there. And I was like, hey, buddy, let's get going here.
It's always interesting because usually when I start going through those, I find something that I've either forgot about or I just haven't seen before. And it always is fun for me to go through them.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, we'll have to categorize and get it. So on to questions from some of us. We only have about 15 minutes left here on the podcast. Let's do it. Let's get right into it. These questions look like they're relatively easy in some of them, and some of them they're more difficult. So question number one, again, Sharla Stevens, thanks for listening and thanks for sending in your questions. Guys, if you have more questions, please send them to diggingupdillinger@gmail.com. She says, thank you. I'm following faithfully. And then with these
awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Sharla.
Yeah. Who owns the Dillinger family farm now?
A relation
of mine. Yep.
Jeff Scaff owns the family farm.
He just
owns the house and a little bit of the ground the house sits on.
And then the family farm behind the property is where we found the map. And
yes, surrounding. Yeah.
Yep. That's owned by a guy named Shane Williams.
Yep.
And Shane's going to be on the podcast coming up soon too.
At one point, Shane actually lived in the, lived in the farmhouse, and I think the when Shane's family sold it, they split up the land a little bit, and the Shane's family kept the land that the farm was on, but the house now is Jeff Scaff owns.
Okay, question number two: why is the family so divided on the issue of John Dillinger? Is it because they're ashamed of the infamy, or they want the past to rest? Why is the family divided on the exhumation issue? So kind of two questions in one question.
Well, I'd say some of them just kind of want it to just rest and not be brought up. A lot of them, some believe it's definitely John. Some have doubts, and which I strongly believed it was him for quite a while. But after I got looking at the FBI files and some other stuff, it definitely gave me doubt.
Yeah.
So for myself and Travis and some of the others, we just like to know for sure one way or another.
And I think too, there's an unfortunate perception that, that this whole endeavor is, to get fame and fortune you know, for us in doing this, and I maybe can see how someone could conclude that, but the fact is, and I guess there's just something you just have to take my word on, that nothing could be further from the truth. This is something that if I could solve it on my own, I would. And if the world never found out about it, it would be something that at least I could know the truth, because that's what this is about. Ultimately, mm-hmm. is just solving, finding out what the real truth was. Again, I think that the questions we have are valid. There's a reason for them. The truth deserves to come out. That's really what it all boils down to. And I'm sorry that there's this perception of it, but the truth is, it's an expensive endeavor. TV networks and so forth have the kind of money to fund these kind of things, and they don't do this out of the goodness of their hearts. They want a return on whatever they invest in. Mm-hmm. So they want to have a show where there'd be viewership, where, you know, they could justify, you know, whatever expense they would have for their investment. So, it's an unfortunate turn of events that, that people perceive this, but it's the reality of it.
What sticks out to me is the ashamed of the infamy part of the question. Like, has that ever been something that your family's dealt with, Mike, where you're ashamed of, like, how, like, the fact that he was a gangster?
I don't think even my mother, I mean, she wasn't proud of what he did, but I don't think she was really ashamed. She knew, I mean, that was her big brother to her.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And her dad was a deacon in the church and stuff. And he kind of got a raw deal. I think she definitely always felt that and kind of thought that is probably why he ended up going the route he did go. But yeah. If he could have got things changed nowadays, people don't do that much time for killing somebody. and it was just attempted robbery.
Yeah,
right, exactly. Right. Now, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And he pissed off the wrong people.
Yep.
John, number three, if John Dillinger's money, quote in quotes, is ever discovered, who will it go to, or will it go to anyone?
Yeah, so that's something that's an issue that we wrestled with talking when we were this whole thing started as an idea to go try to find this loot and go to the known hideouts of the Dillinger gang. And so one of the issues was, if we do actually find something, who would it belong to? Well, what I think is actually out there is not cash. Okay. I don't think there's any cash out there, but we do know from studying the FBI file that there's about $200,000 in bonds that were never recovered. In fact, the FBI file has reports of insurance investigators from insurance companies out trying to find these bonds that they were stolen during bank robberies. I don't know the answer to that, honestly, because any bank that would have issued those bonds back in the day are long gone. They've been bought up or went out of business. So maybe the one answer would be if you can trace, a current operating bank that maybe, bought through mergers or purchases, bought what this bank was back in 1934, they might have some kind of an ownership claim to it.
Come on, baby. It's like a gamble. Come on, baby. We got to hit it. Hopefully Bank of America bond is here.
Yeah. So, but I don't know if even the bonds themselves would have any, if they'd be negotiable now at all. That's another issue too. So that's really kind of an unknown question. I don't know the answer to that question at the moment.
Mike, hey, what do you say about it? About what would you do with the money?
Well, I don't think there is any money. The bonds that'd be interesting, because they may be worth something, because who stole them and that, or if there is a bank or something that they would. But I was just sitting here thinking, when we was going through the FBI files, I remember looking at and noticing at one point, they, in 62, And I can't remember the whole thing without going digging a file out, but it, they were still looking for John in 62. Now, yeah. why would they be still looking for someone?
Yeah, right. You know? That many years later.
Yeah. So I had always, that stuck in my mind when I.
Yeah. But I'm probably the most appropriate thing to happen would be that would be something that would, you know, maybe be in the Smithsonian or something like that. It would, I don't think it's something that, you know, someone could have a financial claim to now, but maybe.
Okay. Good. This is good. What is the theory? Number four, what is the theory on why Crown Hill Cemetery's records are so incomplete? I mean, have you seen the records from Crown Hill, Mike?
Go ahead, Mike.
No, I haven't seen any records. I know that they were surprised I had the original deed to that plot because they said they hadn't seen one. So that was kind of interesting. But it I know that they were all for it. And then supposedly someone contacted them, whether it was FBI or not. But then they changed up and actually hired a group of lawyers that's not even their lawyers to fight it. When they at first they was all for exhuming the body. So I don't know why they did such an about face.
That's still one of the mysteries of this whole thing is. That, you know, supposedly the information we got was they were visited by the FBI and the FBI wanted all their files. And I find it hard to imagine what files beyond, you know, someone comes in and wants to buy a burial plot, you know, and there's a sale for the burial plot. I can't imagine what files beyond that there would be, you know.
Well, the documentation of the exhumation, initial exhumation. Right.
Yeah. But you know, that's all documented too in the FBI file. You know, so it's not like they would need to go get Crown Hill's version of that because they had it in their own files. You know, again, I don't know. The whole thing it was funky. The court hearing we were in was inexplicable. The lawyers that represented Crown Hill were as nervous and uncomfortable in a court hearing as any. And I've been in hundreds of court settings. I've never seen lawyers as nervous and uncomfortable as their lawyers were.
Yes. And the judge was even the judge said, if it wasn't who it was, we wouldn't even be here.
Exactly. Yep.
And then supposedly the FBI went to the health department because they didn't want us to issue us another.
Yeah, and that's documented with the attorney that we were working with as well. Yeah. Yep.
So, but they went ahead and issued this one. So.
Okay, we only got five more minutes, so we got five. Okay. Question number five: has it ever been discovered who paid for the concrete on top of the grave?
As far as I know, it has not.
Because
that's something else that we all speculated about. Is that, you know, at the time, Mr. Dillinger, John Wilson Dillinger, didn't have the money to transport the body back from Chicago. When John was killed in Chicago, I think Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but he had to borrow the money or something, or somebody had to help him.
I think the Morzell. Morzell Times actually fronted the money to bring him back.
So then, you know, a month later or I forget exactly when that exhumation happened and they added the concrete, but not that long after that, you know, there's an exhumation where that, you know, that would have cost money. And then all this concrete that's supposedly on top of the body, you know, that wouldn't have been cheap. So who paid for that? And, you know,
they didn't like just pour concrete. They put individual slabs. I'm not for sure how many. I thought it was like three maybe. But
yeah.
And that's where I got to thinking the more I kept thinking about it. I said, okay, did the Crown Hill realize that he's not actually in there when they did that? Did they move him and maybe put him in another family? Because my grandfather had several brothers, and they have family plots there. Did they move him to one of those?
Yeah.
And so they didn't want us to dig that up and nobody be in it.
Here
we know they buried a body. That was for sure.
Yeah.
There's something funky to it. There's no question about that.
This is good. Charlotte's really kicking our butt on these questions. will the Mooresville Library open up the Dillinger exhibit again? We don't know that. The Mooresville Library will do that. And she said, sorry for missing you guys the first time. Heck, we'll probably be out doing something again one day. Mike, me, Travis. And then hopefully when the boys travel up from Texas, we'll be there too.
We are the Texas crime travelers, so we need to travel.
Yeah,
need
to travel. Do it.
Can you time travel?
Oh, man, I wish so. I wish.
Oh, my gosh. We know where Stewart would go. It would probably not be John. It would probably not be John Dillinger. It would probably be John F. Kennedy.
Well, it would be two places. One would be Chicago on 1934 and then Dallas in
1963.
Yeah. What's the age difference between the three older siblings, Doris, Hubert, and John?
Well, Audrey's the oldest.
Right. Yeah. She forgot.
She's 28 years older than Mom. And then she was 19 years. Let's see. Is that right?
John was born in 1903, and Audrey was born like in 1889, I think.
Yeah. Something like that. And between Mom and Doris, they were only 4 years difference, and
we'll get it. We're gonna jump. We're gonna do it again with everybody, with Mike. We'll be back for another episode, and then we'll have more recommendations. There's a couple more questions from Charlotte, but guys, it's been awesome. We got to keep digging.
Keep digging. I love it. Digging.
And we'll see you next time. Mike, thanks, man.
Shall we get him dug up?
Until we get him dug up. Let's go. All right, all. We'll see you next time. And thanks again for listening. We love you all. We'll see you
soon. Love you. Thanks.
Bye.
The Digging Up Dillinger podcast is produced by Joe Melillo and Grace Hiles. Theme music produced by Eddie Bandis. Follow us on TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube. Until next time, keep digging.